Hey, welcome to the In Balance podcast. My name is Jim Simon.
And I'm Kelsey Solberg.
In Balance animates Gonzaga University's CREATE model for sustainability through interviews and conversations with students, staff, faculty, and community members who practice sustainability on campus and around our region. Today we have Andrea Brower, who is a lecturer in the sociology department at Gonzaga University. We had an awesome conversation with Andrea.
An amazing conversation that probably could have lasted
hours.
Yes.
What stuck out to you, Kelsey?
Yeah, I think what really resonated with me, and I loved that she kind of naturally led us here, but was talking about hope and resilience and like even bringing in her own kind of personal story with that, with having children, and kind of what that's meant to her. And I think that's something really important for us to remember, is that there is hope and there's reason to be hopeful. And I just thought that was really resonant.
Yeah, I think for me, she kind of shook apart some of the kind of calcified stasis that I have with activism and the moment we're in. Something that she said that resonated with me is that the future is always a question in the making. And I think it's really easy to think that the future is set, that there's no control. But I think in how she described social movements and activism and that work, there's always room for everyone at the table to impact and change the future.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And even resting on history, she brought history in a way that I think was really helpful
to
inform our future in a way.
Yeah. I'm excited for everyone to hear Andrea.
I do. Enjoy. Yeah.
Enjoy. Welcome, Andrea.
Thanks.
So glad you came over to the Office of Sustainability today.
Very cozy office.
Very cozy.
Very holiday.
Especially when it is cold outside, like it is today. What's your story? We want to know more about you. How did you get here? Not like what roads did you take to like, left turn, right turn, but like
Centennial from PV.
Yeah. How did you end up teaching Gonzaga students about social justice? I know, just appreciating you, I hear students all the time just rave about you as a instructor and teacher. And I think when you walked in, you experienced that too, because Marissa, I think, probably had you, or at least knows you. So you're kind of a big deal here. So how did you become a big deal?
I didn't actually know that. Sometimes I feel quite peripheral, actually. Although not in my relationship with the students. How did I get to this spot? That is a good question that I'm not entirely certain of yet. It's been a very non-linear path.
Sure.
I was very much immersed in social struggle in Hawaii, which I still am, and which is where I'm from. And I was doing my PhD as a part of my participation in social movement struggle. And when I finished with my PhD in Aotearoa, New Zealand, where I chose to be in large part to learn about the decolonial struggles of Maori and to connect kind of more internationally, more globally, some of the local work I was doing in Hawaii. When I completed that, I was kind of taking a pause and deciding where I wanted to be. And my life has been one that is very much just about sort of responding, listening to the flows. Especially in regards to like my participation and engagement with social movements. So I actually had a couple job offers in Aotearoa, and then Trump got elected. And I just had a deep feeling of responsibility that I needed to be in the United States. And I had never actually, I did my undergrad in California, but I had never lived inland or really in the United States. I don't consider Hawaii, you know, Hawaii is an occupied territory. So I thought Spokane seemed like this interesting microcosm of many things going on in the larger United States. And the I actually hadn't heard of Spokane, and I had a friend living here, and she was visiting me, and she was talking a bit about it, and she was like, check out Gonzaga's webpage, and I did, and a job had just been posted, and I applied for it the next day, and I think I got the job within 3 weeks.
Wow.
Nice. So it was just for a one-year contract in the environmental studies department, and I came, and honestly, my first 2 weeks were very humbling. I had TA'd before, but I hadn't developed my own courses, taught my own courses. And it's a lot of pressure standing up and speaking in front of students every day. And I learned so much in those first few weeks. One, that I give way too much information every single class period. And I would go home and I would feel like so exhausted and so kind of coming off of like nervous energy, because I had this feeling like I was like speaking in front of hundreds of people every day. And I was like, I don't think I'm cut out for this. But I sunk more and more into it. And especially by my second semester, and once I had established relationships with students, just really began loving it. And I didn't know that I would love teaching. So I began to see that as like one element of my participation in social struggle is education. And so I had intended to stay for just a year, and I met my partner about 3 weeks before I was supposed to leave, and we had a beautiful summer together, and then, we're 3 years down the road, and we now have two very surprise miracle babies under two. So things just happened really quick, and I've gotten to know this land, the history of this land a bit more, and just grown to kind of love this place as another home. So yeah, that's how I'm here.
We're glad you're here.
Thanks. Well, being in community with folks like you is really what has made this place really special for me. Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Yeah. What were you teaching when you started? Like those first 2 weeks, what courses were you teaching?
I was teaching Introduction to Environmental Studies and an upper division course that I'm still teaching right now, which is one of my favorites to teach, Capitalism, Environmental Justice, and Resistance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm teaching it actually in the sociology department right now, although it's typically cross-listed with the social justice minor and environmental studies.
Okay.
And then the next semester I was teaching environmental and social movements courses.
Okay.
Yeah. And Gonzaga's been awesome in letting me develop my own courses around like my own passions and my expertise. And that's been really neat because I think it appeals to students when I'm like really, you know, immersed in the topic.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I can speak to that, as you know, my kind of introduction to you, Andrea, was through our doctoral program in leadership studies, and Kim Gambrell had sort of connected us, and I know she knew about the work that you were doing in New Zealand, and she described it to me as being groovy, and was like, we have Andrea teaching in our doctoral program. And so as we've been expanding that, you designed our environmental activism and leadership class. And at the time, I was a master's student in our Orgel program. And I was like, can we cross-list this course at the master's level so I can take it? And I was the only master's student who took it. And I felt...
You did very well, Kelsey.
Speaking of imposter syndrome, being with a bunch of PhD students. But yeah, I mean, I feel lucky to have been a student in one of your classes. And I think what you're speaking about of like that, your passion area shining through, like I very much experienced that in that class. And that for me kind of set me down some other... important paths in my own kind of interest and passion areas. So
that's groovy to hear.
Yeah, it is groovy.
Yeah.
Yes. But so speaking of activism, so that was one of the, that was kind of one of the main threads in that course. And we've been talking a little bit about the CREATE model, and the A in that is activism. And so curious about kind of what you believe about activism, kind of your journey in it, how you think it's changing or has changed or evolved.
Well, activism, just like broadly defined as participation and social struggle, social transformation, is what is going to save the world. I mean, the only thing that can save the world. It is what has historically brought about justice. You know, as Frederick Douglass said, power never concedes anything without a demand. So we have... a history globally of 500 years of highly oppressive, exploitative systems, and a lot of violence and brutality. And the only thing that has pushed against those systems has been activism, grassroots people's power, collectives, people coming together to demand change. So as far as kind of this moment we're in, I think, you know, being the Office of Sustainability, we're all very acutely aware of the environmental tipping points we're at, whether you want to call it, you know, the Anthropocene, the Capitalocene, climate change, climate disaster, climate catastrophe, the sixth extinction, all these things that are coinciding with the most inequitable probably moment in human history as far as at least wealth distribution, distribution of resources, people's basic needs going unmet when there's a capacity to meet people's basic needs. So we're at this, you know, kind of point where things can't really sustain as they are for much longer. And if they do, it's going to look like an increasingly eco-apartheid, eco-fascist world. Or we could transform and into a much more equitable, egalitarian, ecologically regenerative, democratic, horizontal, loving, just society. And not to simplify things too much, but we do kind of face a pretty stark choice. And I think in the mobilized, we see the tendencies in both of these directions, both ramping up right now, right? We see power grabbing really hard to maintain the status quo, and that is taking more violence and more oppression, more militarization of our borders, more kind of extreme greenwashing, and then we also see tendencies in the other direction in pretty remarkable ways, which I think we should talk about. So to your original question, what does sort of activism mean to me, or what is the importance of activism? I mean, collective engagement for really pretty radical, by radical I just mean at the root, social change is our future. That's where the hope lies. So yeah, that's how I think of activism. And but personally, I just see myself one very piece in a collective that is this wider ecosystem of social movements and social change. And my own engagement and how that looks is constantly morphing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that radical at the root. Is that what you wrote down?
That is what I wrote down. Dear listeners, I picked up my pen. Radical at the root, where hope lies. Mm-hmm. I think what you just described with activism, there's an urgency that clearly came across in how you communicated that. And things in general just seem to have sped up over the last few years,
right?
Both the change that we're experiencing, both in society and also the planet, but also just like how activism happens. When I was an activist, or when I was an activist when I was younger, I remember being in basements and painting sheets with words and making giant paper mache heads and bringing them out and carrying them through campus and whatnot for rallies. And now it seems like it's digital. It's on, you know, it's create a TikTok or it's post a meme or post a Twitter tweet, what the kids call these days. Am I on to something, or is that is it both and, or is it, are we heading in the wrong direction with activism? Is it quality, I guess, quality over quantity, is kind of what I'm thinking about there.
So can I answer a couple of things that came up for me
in
that?
Absolutely.
Okay. One just being this sense, and I totally agree that everything is speeding up. So I totally agree, and I want to acknowledge that for 500 years plus, many people have been living on the front lines of white supremacy and imperialism and colonialism and rapacious exploitative capitalism. And I think for some of us who have lived more privileged lives, we're just starting to like feel and see and experience those things a little bit more. So I think there's often this tendency, within myself as well to feel like, wow, things are so bad right now, and feel overwhelmed by that. But I just want to acknowledge that many people have been on the front lines of apocalypse for hundreds of years and survived and danced and lived beautiful lives and still had children. And that's like the resilience and the resistance of the human spirit. At the same time, we're facing new kinds of like planetary kind of like the planet as this whole ecosystem is kind of like, you know, facing like the potential for annihilation in some ways, and the human species and already many, many other species. So, and we're living in a more globalized, rapid, fossil fuel capitalism world where everything speeds around really fast and we communicate really fast. So it's really sped up in those ways. As far as like social movements within that, the specificities of the tactics, like social media or being in uprisings on the streets or doing more of the kind of reproductive labor behind the scenes or being part of the war of ideas and engaging more in the intellect stuff or being part of political education or being part of workers' movements in the workplace, I think all of them are really important, and I don't think we necessarily need to like rank our tactics. At the same time, it is important to be strategic. So I think there's maybe a lot of focus on the specificities of the tactics without thinking about some of like the deeper what's of the social movements. And where I see feel a lot of hope and feel a lot of this kind of like ramping up within social movements is that they have become rapidly more intersectional, more systemic, more focused on like big grand change versus just kind of working in these issue silos. So I guess to your question about, you know, strategy and tactics, all of it can work if it's embedded in this in a wider context of movement building and organizing that is really seeking to build these like intersectional movements that transcend issues and get to root causes. And one of the things that I'm quite inspired by over this the past decade of the kind of evolution of activism is that it seems like many organizers are thinking beyond just like single issues and thinking more about wider movement building. And so all of these things like TikTok and being on the streets, they can all play a part in that. So it's not so much the specificity of the tactic as like how are we thinking more generally about change? What are the aims of our movements? What kind of solidarity are we building?
No, I really appreciate that. I think it's what I heard was it's not just about the tactics, it's about the bigger picture. And I think that acknowledgement that you made kind of in the beginning of the response is really important as well. The speeding up piece, it's been moving downhill for a very long time, and being able to acknowledge the moment when you wake up, I think is really important.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm just also getting older, and some things just don't resonate the same way.
Right.
So, like speaking for myself, I had a moment where I was involved with a number of things, and the tactics that backed up the kind of reason for what I was doing was much different than today.
Sure.
And so I think there's also just, you know, 20 years down the line, a little bit of like, okay, boomer.
Yeah, boomer. Sure. It's always important for fresh energy, and it's always important to know our place in the struggle. And I do think something else that you're touching on as far as tactics go, that's very important, is that movements need to be more than spectacle, right? They also need to be about building power and organizing. And here I'm really kind of quoting the great social movement scholar Frances Fox Piven, and as well as especially labor organizers like Jane McAlevey, who talk about like, sure, it's great to have those moments of outbursts on the street. We need those. Those are an important part of building movements and pushing change. But what is the like ongoing process of building power at the grassroots level and building organizational capacity. And I don't mean within organizations, I mean building the organizing capacity of our grassroots kind of movements. And so we do need to do a lot more than like collectivism, like looking at our phones and spreading messages. Yeah. That actually can be a problematic strategy when we think activism is just clicking on our phones or just going to a rally once a year, right? Yeah. We need to actually be engaged in the sustaining work of building power, building collective power. So sure, all those tactics are important, but those aren't actually enough. Yeah.
When you were talking initially about activism, you were sort of mentioning like this crossroads that we're finding ourselves at right now. And you said we should talk more about that. So thinking about the ones like the movements that are happening that would take us in this direction that is more about stewardship and reciprocity and love and care and all of these things. So if you know, what are the movements that are happening there? So I think curious about that. And then also just, you know, as we're thinking about maybe our young people too and the role that they're playing in that as well. So I guess that's kind of a two-layered question, but I'm curious to hear more about some of what's going on and knowing that people might be interested too to know, like there, because of the globalization of everything, it does feel overwhelming to look and say, where should I try to enter myself? Like, where should I try to put some energy? Mm. So just kind of increased awareness around what movements are happening and where people can get in. And
Well, to the first part of that question, I think we face a pretty stark choice between our world, you know, we're getting more and more unequal. Resources are being more and more hoarded at the top. Power is being more and more hoarded at the top. And as we go into a increasingly climate unstable and more generally environmentally just unstable world, we see these tendencies of the uber wealthy already to kind of like they're purchasing land on Kauai and Aotearoa to basically create their survival bunkers, or they're thinking about going and colonizing space because there's a recognition that what is happening right now really can't last very much longer. So the uber wealthy, which is a smaller and smaller class of folks because much of the quote unquote middle class is becoming the poor and working class and in this country, and are finding their ways to build their walls and protect themselves. And then we see this between nations as well, right? There was a recent report that countries like the United States, Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom are spending double on border security to what they are spending on climate, on adaptation for climate change. So there's a stark choice there, right? Are we keeping people out, or are we moving towards a world where the people who have done the least to contribute to climate change have a home on this planet? Yeah. On the other hand, movements for climate justice, I mean, even from 10 years ago, from kind of this like quite white environmentalist conservationist kind of approach to a much more justice focused, how do we actually transform our systems to deal with equity and our relationship to the wider web of life at the same time. Those movements have become so much more led by frontline communities, led by the youth, really visionary in their demands for an entirely different kind of economy, society, and global future. And like you say, one that's based on reciprocity and cooperation and ultimately justice. By justice, I mean what kind of Cornel West says, justice is what love looks like in public. So those are kind of our choices. And I don't think there's much in between that can be sustained anymore, right? That's the fallacy of centrism, of this kind of these past few decades of we can just find like this middle road solution where we kind of keep business as usual, basically, and don't threaten any of the power interests as they currently exist. Like the lie of that is being exposed right now, especially by the climate justice movement. So, and then to the second part of your question, I guess, like, where are those movements? How do we plug in? I mean, I'm deeply inspired by the climate justice movement, but the climate justice movement is also the Black Lives Matter movement, is also the movement for decolonization, is also the feminist movement, right? Like all these things, that's part of having an intersectional lens of systemic issues, is you start to see how everything is deeply connected and how, sure, your Kuleana, your responsibility may be in like one piece of that, but that doesn't mean that your activism, your engagement needs to be just like very issue-based and reductionist. Your engagement in that issue can be connected to a broader understanding of the need for like deeper change and solidarity across issues, and we can mobilize even around particular issues in ways that are also, you know, intersectional and systemic. So people are pulled to different pieces of that, or maybe there's, you know, moments of outburst in the street around particular manifestations of white supremacy that you feel very called to participate in. I'm wearing my Black Lives Matter sweatshirt right now, so, you know, that's the example I use. But they're all totally connected, right? Black Lives Matter is also about climate justice. Who's being hurt the most by climate change right now? The continent of Africa, which has done nothing, basically, to cause it, and where the fossil fuel imperial capitalism has been imposed on them in violent ways from the start. So yeah, long-winded answer to there's no shortage of places to plug in right now. And more specifically, I think because students often sort of ask me that question, like, well, where do I get involved? And I don't think engagement comes with like a 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 step manual. Social movements aren't linear. The process of social struggle and our own participation and calling within it is not linear either. One of the things that I kind of have learned as a quote unquote activist myself was that there's no way to like really be prepared for what you're going to do, right? You sort of just dive in and you learn as you go, and then your own sense of where you fit into the struggle and what tactics make sense to you evolve as you go. And that's great. That's just part of living and learning. So for students, I just, you know, kind of say like, well, what do you feel really called to? What do you feel passionate about? Are there already folks working on that? Do you need to like initiate something and call in create some comrades around that? And it'll probably, you'll probably start with one thing and it'll look really different a few months later. Yeah. So I think it's a lot about just sort of like listening and being called.
Yeah. And what are you good at? Like, what's your
totally
contribute?
Right. Because not all of us want to like be on a loudspeaker. Not everybody wants to even go to a rally, or, you know, we all have different things that we feel comfortable with, different spaces we feel inclined to participate.
I'm hearing kind of a call for, term this, but inclusive activism, that you anything you do, whatever it is, can be activism. It doesn't have to be one specific thing. There's not a track, which I appreciate, because I think for some, and maybe through the privileged lens that I'm looking through, there could be barriers of entry to activism. What I just heard was there doesn't need to be that, and it can be kind of a level playing field, and there is a lot of radical things that people can do just by living their lives, and it's activism.
Yes. And
please.
Because I'm always wanting to push back on like some of the dominant narratives that I think are perpetuated by those who hold power in the system as it is, to maintain the system. The one piece of, and I don't think this is what you were saying, but I think there has been a tendency in the past decades to think about activism merely as personal lifestyle choice and in a highly individualized way. For example, you know, doing things like recycling and all these really important things. All that is really important. We need to like model the world that we all need to be living in, basically. But it is now being revealed to us, for example, that the plastic industry created a very concerted campaign to individualize consumers' guilt around plastic and teach them to recycle instead of get together as collectives and pass bans on plastic. So the one one, yes, there's a multiplicity of ways to engage, but social engagement is about collectives, and it's about pushing, it's about in some way participating in wider policy, institutional, systemic, cultural change. And that can take a multiplicity of forms. But I do think we need to get outside of our highly individualized silos, especially in this country, in this culture, where we're really taught to individualize everything, including our own guilt about things going on, and almost take it on within ourselves and think like, oh my goodness, I have to solve the problem of sweatshops and fast fashion by like buying $200 American-made ethically produced jeans. I'm not saying that's the answer. I just don't buy clothes. You can get hand-me-down everything you need in this society. But I'm just saying, like, we have a tendency to individualize a feeling of, like, guilt and responsibility. But in actuality, we're, like, born into these systems and these histories and these patterns. And I think we need to, the only way to, like, get out of those historical systemic grooves is to engage as collectives, to go in entirely new directions. But the engagement within that can look very different. It can be, you know, working at the Sustainability House with students. It can be, you know, doing podcasts that like change the narrative about things, introducing new ideas. I actually think the battle over ideas is one of the most important battles we face today. Mm-hmm. And the neolibs, the people who kind of I blame for bringing us to this moment of like super hyper fossil fuel based capitalism, that movement of folks understood very well, as Friedrich Hayek said, that the main thing that they had to engage with was this war over ideas. They had to change what was considered politically possible and what the political common sense was. And their movement was to make the political common sense, basically, that we're all just these individuals who are innately competitive, who want to compete in markets, and therefore the best way to run society is just put everything into the hands of markets, even if they're totally oligopolistic markets, yada yada. Anyway, I'm going on a tangent, but that was the neoliberals' dominant common sense, and what we need to learn from them is how they played in that battle for the public common sense. You know, they funded think tanks, they worked it in universities, they really worked to change kind of the narrative around these things. And so I think we're seeing like this pushback against all of that. And I think engaging in that battle over ideas is super, super important. Sorry.
Oh, don't be sorry.
I'm like going off.
Everything you said makes sense.
Okay.
What you thought I wasn't saying is not what I was saying.
What I thought you wasn't saying.
Yeah, I don't
okay.
know. I think I encounter maybe at a basic level what you're describing in I work with students who are very focused on those individual things like straws. We need to mm-hmm. ban straws, ban single-use plastics. And I'm trying to, as I grow and learn, trying to evolve into, let's not talk about straws in the nose of a turtle. Let's talk about how it got there and the systemic
right.
issues of consumption.
Yes.
Let's lift it out of there. And I call it like the hole in the bucket problem. Like people are looking at water streaming out of holes. And I'm saying, well, let's think about where the water's coming
yes.
from. And not just put fingers in the bucket mm-hmm. and stop the water.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And that's where I'm quite heartened by it might sort of feel slow, this sort of shift within social movements to looking at the bigger bucket, but it's actually happening pretty quickly.
It seems that way.
Yeah. Like if you just think about, I think about capitalism a lot. And in 2014, when I was writing my thesis, it's like the only people really talking about capitalism were like leftist intellectuals on the mm-hmm. periphery. It was starting to be a little bit more normalized with the Occupy movement. But now it's like, it's part of the conversation. Yeah. And that's just one example. I mean, things like prison abolitionism and like these things that were considered really radical and only talked about in certain circles are now like entering common public discourse. And I find that like very, very hopeful.
Yeah.
Do you feel like there's been a shift to, when, you know, when we're talking about the shift from looking at kind of the results of systemic issues rather than the systems themselves? It also has me thinking too about like our, like how people are internalizing that approach to like problem solving, or, you know, and thinking about it more on an individual level, and how that's even manifested in like how we see ourselves in the world, and like existing as an individual in this mentality of like pulling myself up by my own bootstraps and I will get there, rather than like familial or like leaning on our communities. I feel like there's just like a general sense of individualism, and I feel like it's been like we have internalized it as human beings, not just as like members of society. Does that make sense? It's almost like a like our identity kind of like we've internalized it so much.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in this country especially.
Mm-hmm. Yes,
yeah.
Yes.
Well, I think, you know, we're all products of our society, right? And we're incredibly malleable beings. Like, we have the capacity for very different types of cultures and social relationships. And our human history and our human present is full of examples of very different ways of being. But the settler society within this country has been probably most defined by this false idea of individualism, that we're separate from the whole, that we can survive without the whole, that, and that as individuals we can do whatever the heck we want, which is just, you know, not only does what we do affect others, but also the mythology of meritocracy, I think, is maybe even starting to fall apart in this country a little bit. So yeah, I think that's been one of the myths that has sustained capitalist settler society in the United States, is the myth of individuality and meritocracy, and that we can all climb these ladders to success. I forget where I was going with that, but I think that is being challenged by social movements, by other cultures, and by even our own innate sense that there's something that's off about that. I mean, it doesn't really feel right. Yeah. It doesn't actually, and when we actually observe how we interact and move around the world in our day-to-day lives, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah.
And most people know that they that their chances of climbing the social ladder are, I mean, most people don't really believe that myth of the American dream if they're anywhere near the bottom of it. Maybe the people towards the top believe it, or it justifies their position at the top, that they got there that way. But most people who are born lower in these hierarchies of oppression know that it's a bunch of baloney. And yeah, I forget what I was gonna say.
Well, that was great.
Yeah. I would consider us all adults, even though maybe we're children. Children. So how do we equip students here, just wherever we are in the future, for an uncertain future?
Mm-hmm.
How do we equip our students for an uncertain future?
That question makes me a little emotional, because I'm also thinking about my kids and how young they are. And you look at these, I mean, I never thought I would have kids, in part because of where the world's at. It just kind of happened.
Yeah.
And in some ways, I look back at, you know, there's a great scene in that film, Judas and the Black Messiah, where Fred Hampton and his partner are talking about, you know, bringing kids into the revolution. And it's kind of like, well, people have made this decision over and over again. So anyway, that question hurts my heart in a new way.
Yeah. It relates to that.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because it is very uncertain, as you say. So how do we prepare them for that? I mean, I think helping them to be as resilient as possible in every way, shape, and form, which is to maybe experience the diversity of the human experience, even in moments of like chaos and breakdown, that there is still lots of beauty and so much to delight in and so much love. So really kind of like filling them with that piece. With my students, I think the main two things I feel like I can help them with or equip them with are a deep systemic critical lens to assess everything they see today and into the future as they go about their lives. So less the facts and figures and specificities, and more that like way of seeing and understanding the world that will help them to be quite frank, in essence, to sort through the BS as they move forward. So as they themselves are agents of environmental activism, to spot the greenwashing from the true solutions, just to give one example. So first, to kind of equip them with that critical lens. And second, and more importantly, I think to let them know, based on historical fact, that change is possible. It's always possible. The future is always a question in the making. It's always a matter of human actions in the present, in the now. And it's very much up for grabs. And even in moments where things maybe seem super bad, or you just learn for the first time about some issue that you just feel like, you know, emotionally kind of paralyzed by, to recall that humans have faced remarkable oppression and overcome deep oppression and changed systems, and that our human history is full of examples of us living in remarkably like reciprocal, egalitarian, loving ways, and to know that those are our human capacities, and that we could move into that kind of future. So the hope piece, I think, is the most important thing we can equip students with, and hope that is not based on like these kind of like false cliches, you know, like you should just be hopeful, and you know, that's
live, laugh, love.
Oh, golly. Yeah, don't get me started on those. I mean, those in a lot of ways are basically put your head in the sand, right? I mean, in some ways, like, that, like, distract yourself with consumerism. No. Have your eyes wide open. Right. Feel the pain of the world. Cry about it. Yell about it. Like, our anger and our grief is righteous and it's appropriate. And it's the correct response to what we're facing. Like, yeah. We should feel a lot. But once those feelings paralyze us from action, that becomes a problem.
Yeah.
And I really think the biggest challenge we face today, besides concentrated power, or right alongside concentrated power, is people's cynicism.
Mm-hmm.
So I hear a lot about people being apathetic, and I don't buy that. I do not think people are apathetic. I think people care deeply about one another, and I think it is our most innate trait. And fields as diverse as neuroscience and biology to psychology are showing this, right? That we are born beings that need to connect. We depend on each other for survival. We are, amongst the animal kingdom, we are the most sociable animals. And so those innate kind of biological tendencies with us could be the basis for a new kind of future. And we have many examples from our human past, and we have examples in our present. Just the way we relate to each other on a day-to-day basis is you know, based on these principles of care and reciprocity and mutual aid and sharing and cooperation. So again, I'm on some tangent, but oh, I remember. I was saying I don't believe that people are apathetic. I think that people don't feel their power in relation to one another. They don't think that they can touch real meaningful change. Sure, they think maybe they can do these lifestyle things, but they haven't really been taught. They have actually actively been untaught that they can do anything. And there's a lot of intentional propaganda around this. We're like, there are intentional efforts to make us cynical and to make us, to take us away from knowing our power in relation to one another and the collective. So I think one of the greatest dangers we face is that cynicism. It's why corporations even use this tactic quite often. They breed public cynicism. And so I think that is one of the things we have to most fight against. So back to your original question, the most important thing we can equip our students, our children with, is a sense of hope based on these very real facts of our innate potential to live in other ways, our long human history of that, and the fact of social change being possible.
I feel like you really, I mean, our last question was about what does it look like to model hope for others, and I think you so much touched on that, right? Resilience and hope. Is there anything else you want to say about hope?
I guess just to, yeah, the question of modeling hope. I think we can't just model it. It has to be genuine. And for me, that if I'm honest about it, it is an oscillation. Some days are you feel really sad about what's happening. And I think that it's good to feel that and to communicate that and to grieve in public with each other, you know, to have collective ways to deal with this and to not isolate in it. And as far as actually feeling hope, I mean, I take tremendous inspiration from even people who are on totally different ends of a political spectrum, although I don't believe in the political spectrum. Well, even people who I'm just like maybe not on the same page with about my politics, like I still feel like we have something innately in common and that most of us kind of want similar things. We want lives where we're in relationship to others, and most of us don't. I mean, nobody really wants to be breathing air pollution, and like there's a more beautiful world that most of us, the vast majority of us, would benefit from. So I take hope in feeling that ultimately our commonality is very strong, that most of the divisions between us are manufactured by hundreds of years of white supremacy and imperialism and a class-based system, and that we could overcome those things, and that it, at our deepest kind of core, most of us really want to. And I take hope from kind of a longer perspective of history. So I don't know if either of you are familiar with David Graeber. He's a great anthropologist, activist, scholar who really sadly died last year at the age of 59. But he was a leader in the Occupy movement, although he would never call himself a leader because he's an anarchist. He's very much a horizontalist, credited in part with coining that "we are the 99% slogan. Anyway, he wrote many books, but kind of the apex of his career was this 700-page book that's just about to come out with a team of other researchers that's really surveying the anthropological and archaeological research of the past several decades on human society. Past. And there's been this narrative that, I mean, I'm reading textbooks that were published this year in sociology of all disciplines that uphold this narrative and don't even talk about it as being contested. But there's been this dominant narrative that, sure, at one point we may have lived in more equal societies, but that's when we were hunter-gatherers, that's when we were very small and nomadic, and that as soon as we developed agriculture and created larger scale, more complex societies, we created hierarchy, and that these two things were in binary, and they totally blow that up. With all of this research that they have a 70-page reference list in this book. So the research is actually showing that there are innumerable examples from our past of complex, densely populated societies that were remarkably equal, with equitable gender roles and many a world where many forms of gender and sexuality fit, and that were not class-based systems, and that were not conquest-oriented, and that we even have all these examples of societies that were very hierarchical and evolved into more equitable societies based on some kinds of, they don't know exactly what happened, but it doesn't even look like they were violent revolutions, that they actually came into more equitable social relationships that sustained for hundreds of years. So there is so much from our past to be hopeful about, and we know so little of our human history because so much has been erased by colonialism. But what we do know, I actually take a lot of inspiration from. So I think taking that longer view of human history and not just reducing it to, so often we don't know anything of our history, but also not reducing it to the past 500 years where we've seen kind of the birth of European expansionism and conquest and these other things, but that 200,000-year history of humanity and that we have so much potential.
And it's proven.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. These aren't just nice ideas.
Yeah.
These are like evidenced. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Hard right.
Okay. Oh, uh-oh.
We have a couple fun questions for you.
Oh, okay.
Not that this wasn't fun.
Yeah. I've talked to you forever.
Yes, this has been so wonderful to have you in conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you so much.
Well, same. This is part of the revolution,
yeah.
Right? Is talking
yeah.
to comrades
yeah.
and sharing ideas.
Yeah.
And...
Mm-hmm. No, thank you so much.
Yeah.
So we're just looking for whatever comes to your mind first when I prompt you.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Rapid fire.
Rapid oh, fire. Oh, okay.
What's your favorite book?
Oh, no. Oh, I can't put them in like a ranking. Oh, that's,
well,
that's actually a
everyone
really...
should read.
Yeah.
That's not the 700-page one coming out.
Right.
That sounds
fast. Okay, which I haven't read myself yet, so I was going to say that. That's, oh my goodness, that is so much pressure. Like top 10? Okay. Can I just say like some must-read authors for
yeah.
this
yeah,
moment
that's great.
We're in?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay. Nick Estes, because he's probably coming here. I'm working with some students.
I have Red Nation on my desk.
Awesome. Yes. Okay, so for bringing together the conversations around colonialism and capitalism, anybody living in the United States needs to read Nick Estes right now, and his co-author, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, in An Indigenous People's History of the United States. I think Naomi Klein is always very spot on in her analysis and her intersectional thinking. Angela Davis was the first professor I had in university, and so her thinking continues to inform me in every way, shape, and form. There's the greats, right? Everybody has to read Howard Zinn to understand people's history from below. Kianga Yamada Taylor is one of my favorite public intellectuals of this moment, writing on everything from Black Lives Matter to capitalism and housing, and her general commentary on our political moment, I just think is so spot on. And any one of those people I just mentioned is also accessible on podcasts right now, which is awesome.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's so many more, but
thank you.
I think I said my top. I think I said five.
What's the last concert you went to?
Oh, Duran Jones and the Wonders in the Spokane Arena like a month ago.
Amazing.
It was so good. Mm-hmm. And it was the first concert I had been to in a couple years because, you know, this baby at home thing.
And this whole pandemic thing.
Oh,
too, yeah.
Right. That, of course. Oh,
yeah.
There were no concerts. I did go to some of those online ones, though.
Okay.
But, yeah, it was great. Are you familiar?
Is that the Riverfront Park?
Yeah.
My Morning Jacket opener?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So it was My Morning Jacket, but I kind of went for the opener because I didn't know My Morning Jacket, which was also phenomenal.
Yes.
But Duran Jones and the Wonders is, yeah,
nice.
Super soulful.
Oh, okay. Love that.
Yeah.
Have you listened to the Black Pumas?
No.
I think if you like Duran Jones, you would like that.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Check them out. What's your favorite restaurant?
Like in Spokane?
Anywhere.
You need it to be narrower than
okay.
Yeah,
that's
helpful.
Man, favorite is again like a hard, like it's
yeah.
loaded, huh?
It's really
my favorite restaurant.
Like if you were gonna go out to dinner tonight.
Oh, okay. If I was gonna go out to dinner tonight, I would want to go to. These things are like really high stakes right now because like our time alone. You know, to be honest, I'm starting to think more about the cocktails and the happy hour deals.
Yeah.
So I give a shout out to Durkin's and the Elk for just a good
yeah.
like. Deck happy hour because a lot of it's the vibe.
Yes, totally.
Spokane has a lot of great local restaurants.
Yeah, for sure.
I love walking to Varachi from our house.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How'd you get to work today?
I walked here.
You walked here.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. That's along the river from Peaceful Valley. It was chilly.
Yes.
The ice was like, it was like mist coming off the river.
Yeah,
it was so cold.
This is another kind of favorite question because I think you're going to enjoy it. In 2030, Spokane will ...
Okay.
Fill it in.
Yes. Well, we will have, I mean, everything that you said is ramping up is going to have ramped up so much faster in the most positive sense, and we'll have all these metamorphoses, and there's going to be electrified public transportation. I'm not even going to need a car. 2030? Yeah, let's see. That's nine years away. there's going to be, like, urban food growing everywhere on all the houses. We're going to be seeing a massive investment in super efficient public housing. Nobody will be living on the streets. There will be affordable or free housing for everybody. Everybody will be fed. Food, healthcare, and housing will be decommodified. our river will be clean in 2030.
I'm looking around to see.
I'll wait.
These are, I guess I'm just having some of the visions of things like a Green New Deal, right? Yeah, we're going to have radically expanded our public spaces and public consumption, our public libraries and parks and such, and reduced private consumption. There's not going to be a Walmart. We're just going to have a bunch of secondhand stores. We're going to be working a lot less because we're going to be having a lot more time for leisure and play and less private consumption and more time for our public lives together.
That's beautiful.
Yeah.
I'll take it.
And I'm really only half joking because these things, the movement for these things is happening quickly, right? Yeah. And when we see debates around even like a $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, which still isn't enough, but like the things that are on the table, 12 million units of public housing Ilhan Omar proposed. Like, you know, these things are not out of the realm of possibility. And even though we haven't won them yet, the debate is more and more happening on our terrain.
Yeah.
It's possible.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Yeah.
This was wonderful.
It was really fun.
Have you on the podcast.
I'm really glad to
have you. You set the bar.
Yeah. Oh, thanks. Yeah. What's the future for the podcast itself? Is this like season three or
season
are we at the end of
three.
Season two?
You are episode two of season three.
Got it. Okay.
And
who's episode one?
Lars Gilbert's.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, you know Lars.
Yeah.
So yeah, and it's kind of like jazz. We'll see what's next.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is my first season.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So we're trying the co-host.
Well, you make a good team.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Yeah. Very
appreciate
good team.
It.
Yeah.
This is fun.
It is.
So, thank you.
Mm-hmm. My pleasure.
This is what Erica said to do, right?
Yes. End scene.
Hello there. Hey, welcome to the Inbalance Podcast. My name is Jim Simon.
And I am Kelsey Solberg.
That doesn't work, because then I'm going to read the next thing.
What are we? Okay.